battle against them. Lewis thought of the mosquitoes as a pest, not a threat. Nor did he ever learn how to spell his enemy's name. His usual spelling, repeated at least 25 times, was M-U-S-Q-U-E-T-O-E. Clark was more inventive. He had at least 20 variations, ranging from M-E-S-Q-U-E-T-O-R-S through M-I-S-Q-U-T-R to M-U-S-Q-U-E-T-O-R-S. In many ways, the trip down the Ohio was a shakedown voyage for the boat and pirogues. Getting the packing right, for example, was a constant learning process. On September 15th, it rained hard for 6 hours. Lewis kept paddling and made 18 miles. The following day, it was 19 miles, but by dusk, my men were very much fatigued. The next morning, the expedition came to a long sandbar. It was a handsome, clean place, so Lewis decided to spend the day opening and drying his goods, which I had found were wet by the rain on the 15th. Even though he had wrapped them securely in oilcloths and had the canoes constantly baled during the course of the day. The guns, tomahawks, and knives were rusting. Lewis had them oiled and exposed to the sun. Clothing of every description also was opened and aired. All hands, including the captains, were kept busy in this enterprise from 10 o'clock a.m. to sunset, when Lewis had the canoes reloaded, this time paying more attention to getting vulnerable items up off the canoe bottom. From Marietta, it was about 100 miles southeast to the point where Ohio, Virginia, and Kentucky joined, then another 100 or so to Cincinnati. The river was deep, the weather fine. Lewis covered the 200 miles in 2 weeks without incident. He stayed in the Cincinnati area for a week to rest his men, take on provisions, do some research for Jefferson, and write two letters. The first was to Clark in Louisville in reply to a letter of August 21st, which Lewis had just picked up. Clark reported that he had many applicants for the expedition, from stout, likely fellows, but he was putting them on hold until Lewis got to Louisville and could look them over. Clark pointed out what he knew Lewis already knew, that a judicious choice of our party is of the greatest importance to the success of this vast enterprise. On a more general note, Clark concluded, "I am happy to hear of the cession of Louisiana to the United States. This is an inestimable treasure to the Western people, who appear to feel its value." Lewis responded by reporting his progress and discussing the selection of men for the voyage up the Missouri. He said he liked Clark's ideas on the need for a judicious selection, and that he had two young men with him, taken on trial conditionally only, though I think they will answer tolerably well. Apparently, he meant John Coulter and George Shannon. Obviously, he meant that Clark would have a veto over his choices, just as he would over Clark's. Lewis and Clark had not been together in 7 years, but even before they met, their partnership was flourishing, their trust in each other's judgment complete. There were no perils in divided command for this pair. The second letter was to Jefferson. Lewis reported on his visit to Big Bone Lick, Kentucky, some 20 miles southwest of Cincinnati. Earlier in the year, Dr. William Goforth had discovered there the bones of a mammoth. Evidently, Jefferson had urged Lewis to visit the site. Lewis did, and sent in a mammoth report on the mammoth, including 2,064 words to describe a tusk of an immense size, along with some specimens of bones. Lewis asked the president to send him some of the vaccine matter, as I have reason to believe from several experiments made with what I have that it has lost its virtue. He intended to use it to vaccinate against the smallpox. This, too, was a favorite subject of Jefferson's, who had sponsored the use of the cowpox and had inoculated himself and his family. The wording of the letter indicates that it was Jefferson who had provided Lewis with cowpox to bring to the frontier and to the Indians, and instructed him in its use. The big problem, as Lewis's request reflects, was keeping the vaccine alive. When no scab formed where Lewis scratched the cowpox vaccine into a patient's arm, Lewis knew it was no longer virile. Lewis concluded his letter to Jefferson with a statement of intentions. "As this session of Congress has commenced," he began, "and as for a variety of reasons his progress had been delayed, and feeling as I do in the most anxious manner a wish to keep them, the politicians, in a good humor on the subject of the expedition in which I am engaged, I have concluded to make a tour this winter on horseback of some 100 miles through the most interesting portion of the country adjoining my winter establishment. He said he would go up the Kansas River toward Santa Fe, and he proposed to have Clark make his own excursion through some other portion of the country. That way, by the end of February, he would be able to send Jefferson such information relative to that country which, if it does not produce a conviction of the utility of the project, will at least procure the further toleration of the expedition. Here was the president's aide at work, a zealot protecting his boss from the Federalist jackals in Congress. Here was the partisan politician trying to give his party a winning issue in the upcoming 1804 presidential campaign. Here, too, was the young adventurer, resigned to having to build a winter camp near St. Louis rather than getting on up the Missouri a few 100 miles, his mind alive with possibilities during the brilliant fall afternoons on the Ohio, refusing to submit to the anticipated dullness of an army camp life for 5 months. But alive though his mind was, here was a young man who had not thought things through. This was the first Jefferson knew that Lewis had abandoned hope of getting up the Missouri before winter. He accepted the decision, indeed endorsed it heartily, because he wanted Lewis to spend the winter gathering information in St. Louis, not out on the Kansas prairie, and because the expedition could draw its rations from the U.S. Army posts on the Mississippi, thus not depleting the stores for the voyage. So, as commander-in-chief, Jefferson had said directly to Lewis, "I leave it to your own judgment as to where to spend the winter." Not that the president had a lot of choice. The mails moved so slowly there was not the slightest possibility of Jefferson's giving Lewis orders that could arrive in time to be acted on. Jefferson did not receive Lewis's letter until mid-November. His reply did not reach Lewis until January. Still, Jefferson tried to take control because he was so alarmed by Lewis's proposal to set off on a midwinter exploration toward Santa Fe, into the part of the continent clearly Spanish and, because of its gold and silver mines, a part about which the Spanish were extremely sensitive. The great danger involved led Jefferson to issue a direct order, hoping it would arrive in time. "You must not undertake the winter excursion which you propose in yours of October 3rd. Lewis's proposal caused Jefferson great worry, not just about the dangers, but about Lewis's judgment. Thus, there is a note of suppressed alarm in his response. He could hardly remove Lewis from the command, but he could try to get Lewis to think of first things first. Jefferson wrote, "The object of your mission is single, the direct water communication from sea to sea formed by the bed of the Missouri and perhaps the Oregon." That was the most succinct statement about the purpose of the expedition Jefferson ever wrote. He explained that the dangers of a Santa Fe trip would be greater than those Lewis would face on the Missouri, because the Spanish armed forces would be almost certain to arrest and detain him if he went southwest, but leave him alone on the Missouri, since that was now American territory. As to Clark's proposed excursion, Jefferson wrote, "By leaving Mr. Clark with you, we consider the expedition double-manned, and therefore the less liable to failure, for which reason neither of you should be exposed to risks by going off of your line." The Louisiana Purchase had another impact on the goals of the expedition. Jefferson described the boundaries of Louisiana as "the high lands enclosing all the waters which run into the Mississippi or Missouri directly or indirectly." That was stretching the boundaries a bit, perhaps. No one really knew. But as Jefferson explained, "it therefore becomes interesting to fix with precision by celestial observations the longitude and latitude of the sources of those rivers." What he meant, or hoped for, was that northern tributaries of the Missouri would extend well north of the 49th parallel, deep into the fur-rich country of western Canada. If so, that territory wasn't western Canada. It was the property of the United States. Jefferson didn't want to risk not finding out because his young captain had indulged himself in a joyride. He concluded his letter by repeating his order that Lewis stick to his assigned missions, which were not to be delayed or hazarded by any episodes whatever. On October 4th or 5th, Lewis pushed his boat and pirogues back into the river and headed west for the falls of the Ohio, some 100 miles downstream. On October 14th, he was at the head of the falls, which were actually long rapids created by a 24-foot drop of the river over a 2-mile-long series of limestone ledges. At the foot of the rapids, on the north bank, was Clarksville, Indiana Territory. Louisville, Kentucky, was on the south bank. On October 15th, Lewis hired local pilots who took the boat and pirogues into the dangerous but passable passage on the north bank. Safely through, Lewis tied up at Clarksville and set off to meet his partner, who was living with his older brother, General George Rogers Clark. When they shook hands, the Lewis and Clark expedition began. Each man was about 6 feet tall and broad-shouldered. Each was rugged in the face, Clark somewhat more so than Lewis, who had a certain delicacy to his profile. Their bodies were raw-boned and muscled, with no fat. Their hands, sunburned like their faces, even this late in the season, were big, rough, strong, capable, confident. Each man was long-legged. Just a glimpse of their stride across a porch, or at how they seated themselves, showed the physical coordination of an athlete. Each, probably, was dressed in fringed buckskin. And who can doubt that as they stuck out their hands to each other, both men had smiles on their faces that were as broad as the Ohio River, as big as their ambitions and dreams? Oh, to have been able to hear the talk on the porch that afternoon, and on into the evening, and through the night. There would have been whiskey. General Clark was the host, and General Clark was a heavy drinker. There would have been tables groaning under the weight of pork, beef, venison, duck, goose, fish, fresh bread, apples, fresh milk, and more. There were the two would-be heroes with the authentic older hero, all three Virginians, all three soldiers, all three Republicans, all three great talkers, full of ideas and images and memories and practical matters and grand philosophy, of Indians and bears and mountains never before seen. Excitement and joy ran through their questions and answers, words coming out in a tumble. Unfortunately, we don't have a single word of description of the meeting of Lewis and Clark. Over the next 2 weeks, the captain selected the first enlisted members of the expedition. They did not lack for volunteers. Word had spread up and down the Ohio and inland, and young men, longing for adventure and ambitious for a piece of land of their own, set out for Clarksville to sign up. Lewis and Clark sized them up, making judgments on their general hardiness, their shooting and hunting ability, their physical strength and general character, their suitability for a long journey in the wilderness. How many applied is not known, but one of those eventually selected, Private Alexander Willard, boasted in his old age that his fine physique enabled him to pass the inspection for enlistment in the expedition that more than 100 others failed. 7 of the men the captains picked had previously been conditionally approved by Clark, 2 by Lewis. They made Charles Floyd and Nathaniel Pryor sergeants. Floyd was the son of Captain Charles Floyd, who had soldiered with George Rogers Clark. When these 9 men were sworn into the Army, in solemn ceremony, in the presence of General Clark, the Corps of Discovery was born. In addition to the enlisted men, the Corps consisted of the captains and Clark's slave, York. York was big, very dark, strong, agile, a natural athlete. About Clark's age, or a bit younger, he had been Clark's lifelong companion, bequeathed to him by his father, whose companion had in turn been York's father. Certainly, the captains discussed the size of the expedition. Secretary of War Dearborn had authorized 12 enlisted men and an interpreter, but Jefferson had orally given Lewis authorization to engage any other men, not soldiers, that I may think useful. Back in 1783, General Clark had advised Jefferson that if the American Philosophical Society did send out an expedition to explore the Missouri country, they should keep it small, a dozen at most, because any larger party would arouse the Indians to hostile acts. In 1803, he may have repeated that advice to his younger brother and Captain Lewis, but if he did, they ignored it. They intended a much larger party. According to a locally written newspaper story, it was said around Louisville that about 60 men will compose the party. How many of them would be soldiers attached to the Corps of Discovery, how many soldiers who would go only as far as the first winter camp, how many civilians hired to power the keelboat was to be determined. In any event, the Corps of Discovery had been formed, and the captains were pleased with the stout young fellows they had picked. The keelboat and pirogues set off from Clarksville on October 26th. There was plenty of water and no obstacles. On November 11th, the party arrived at Fort Massac, built 10 years earlier on the Illinois bank of the Ohio, about 35 miles upstream from the junction of the Ohio and the Mississippi. There, Lewis expected to find 8 soldiers who had volunteered from the army camp at Southwest Post, Tennessee, but they hadn't been seen. Lewis immediately hired George Driard, a locally renowned woodsman, to go to Tennessee, pick up the missing soldiers, and bring them on to winter quarters, which he should look for on the east bank of the Mississippi near St. Louis. Although he never learned how to spell Driard's name, it usually came out Druyer, Lewis was impressed by him from the start. Son of a French-Canadian father and a Shawnee mother, Driard was a skilled frontiersman, hunter-trapper, and scout. He was an expert in Indian ways, fluent in a couple of Indian languages and in French and English, and master of the sign language. He exuded a calm confidence, giving the strong impression that no matter what happened, he could handle it. Lewis signed him to a contract to serve as interpreter at $25 per month and arranged for the paymaster at Massac to advance him $30 in coin. Though Lewis was authorized to draw volunteers from the garrison at Fort Massac, he was disappointed in the quality of the men who stepped forward. Only 2 met his standards. On November 13th, the expedition set off from Massac. There was a heavy rain. "I was seized with a violent ague," Lewis wrote in his journal, "which continued about 4 hours and, as is usual, was succeeded by a fever which, however fortunately, abated in some measure by sunrise." He had malaria. When he woke, "I took a dose of Rush's pills which operated extremely well." The fever passed. That night, the party landed on the point at which the Ohio and Mississippi flowed together. For the following week, Lewis and Clark made measurements and conducted celestial observation. With his measuring chain and circumferenter, or surveying compass, Clark determined by triangulation that the width of the Ohio at the point just before junction was 1,274 yards, that of the Mississippi 1,435 yards, and of the combined rivers 2,002 yards. During the encampment at the mouth of the Ohio, Lewis began to apply the lessons he had learned in Philadelphia on celestial observation, and simultaneously to teach Clark what he knew. Establishing latitude was complicated but doable in the field. Using the octant in the summer, or the sextant, winter, Lewis would shoot the sun at noon and take its altitude. He would then consult a table to determine latitude. The angle of the sun at high noon, together with the date, would tell him for certain how far north of the equator he was. Determining longitude was almost impossibly complicated. If Lewis knew it was high noon in Greenwich, and he knew exactly what time it was where he was, he could figure out his longitude. But to know the time in Greenwich required an accurate chronometer. Though Lewis had bought the best available in Philadelphia, it was not reliable. The alternative was to note the regular movement of the moon, measured against the sun and stars. The method was to choose a bright star as a fixed point against which to measure the moon's easterly motion in its orbit around the Earth. The stars that could be used for the measurement were Antares, Altair, Regulus, Spica, Pollux, Aldebaran, Fomalhaut, Alphi, Arietis, and Alplopagus. Lewis could identify those stars and many others, a skill that he had absorbed in the course of his life. He had spent countless nights stretched out in the open, countless hours staring at the stars. He had enjoyed the privilege of walking the grounds after dark at the President's House and at Monticello with Thomas Jefferson for his guide to the skies. The skill also grew out of his character. His intense curiosity compelled him to study the world around him and the sky above him. His crash course in Philadelphia enabled him to make the observations. It was complicated. With the sextant, every few minutes he would measure the angular distance between the moon and the target star. The figures obtained could be compared with tables showing how those distances appeared at the same clock time in Greenwich. Those tables were too heavy to carry on the expedition, and the work was too time-consuming. Since Lewis's job was to make the observations and bring them home, he did not try to do the calculations. He and Clark just gathered the figures. It meant staying up till midnight, making observations every 5 minutes or so for an hour or more. It meant frustration on those nights, too frequent, when clouds came up to render observation impossible. The sky over the dark, murmuring river was black and transparent, free of any pollutants, far from any glowing village. Behind the captains, the men slept in their tents, the quiet sleep of healthy young men exhausted from the day's labors. The private on guard duty kept a small fire burning. Lewis's dog sat beside him as he called out the numbers for Clark. This was practice. The longitude and latitude of the mouth of the Ohio were known, but Lewis and Clark worked at it as if it were the real thing, because soon enough it would be. Seaman was always with Lewis. On the afternoon of November 16th, the captains crossed to the Spanish side of the Mississippi to make observations. They encountered a camp of Indians. One of them, a respectable-looking Indian, offered Lewis 3 beaver skins for Seaman. Lewis refused with considerable indignation. He pointed out that he had paid $20 in cash for the dog. Besides, Lewis wrote, "I prized Seaman much for his docility and qualifications generally for my journey." On November 18th, Lewis complained that the men had discovered a nearby illegal trading post with whiskey as the main trade item. He issued orders to stay away, but a number of the men went anyway and got drunk. Whiskey and whiskey traders were the bane of frontier life. Lewis had to anticipate more trouble with drinking during the long winter nights coming up. On November 20th, the expedition set out for St. Louis. Now it was headed upstream, and would continue to labor upstream until it reached the Continental Divide somewhere in the Rocky Mountains.